Hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast, your weekly dose of inspiration and exploration. Join me, your host, Sam Harris, as I discover how mindset can help you do incredible things through my conversations with the world's most interesting people, from tech billionaires to leading scientists, best-selling authors to notorious hackers. The goal is to increase our collective wisdom and attitudes to make us all happier and healthier, wiser and wealthier. Who doesn't want that? What up to all my growth mindset listeners? So you're about to listen to one of the biggest knowledge bombs of your life, covering all things legal and raising investment. So Anthony is a legend and just a crazy knowledgeable guy. This was possibly the easiest interview of my life because he literally just interviews himself the whole podcast. I think I say like the odd thing about every 10 minutes. I just like pop in with the odd, like, oh, can we talk about this? And boof, he just unloads pure gold information about the topic. It's a bit of background. He literally shaped the internet that we know today, and he's had more exits than a 747. Okay, that's a joke and probably isn't true. But anyway, he co-founded Kazaa, one of the original music sharing websites, and he was the CTO of the BBC iPlayer during its launch, and was described by Wire magazine as the man who saved the BBC, which is a pretty good description. And he has also founded Beamly, Six Tribes, Hey Blab, and QJam, which is a lot of things to be doing. His current business, Seed Legals, has worked with 3,500 companies to help them with their legals and to raise investment. So simply put, he knows an incredible amount about the process of starting, growing, and selling a business, and the top tips and biggest pitfalls that people face. In the episode, we don't talk about the BBC a lot, and instead he shares his wisdom from a life in tech and what someone starting a business today should know. We join the conversation with him explaining how he had his current business idea.
Decided it was time for startup life again, built a startup, sold it. Invested in it, got tired of paying lawyers, and then met my business partner, Laurent Lafitte. We met at an investor's party, actually, and Laurent was saying in his French accent, those lawyers, they charge their fortunes, they make mistakes, they take forever, we should change it. So having just sold my last startup, I thought, interesting idea. And we got together afterwards, and Laurent had been working for months, literally 6 months. He's an ex-VC and serial angel investor. He'd been working for 6 months on this gigantic spreadsheet, analyzing hundreds of rounds and the deal terms that people really negotiate on in rounds. And he's a total genius at this, and he'd been looking to see, as an angel investor, he'd done 40 or 50 rounds. As a VC, he'd done dozens as well. And why was it so slow and so hard? And had eventually sort of reduced rounds to a standard set of things that the vast majority looked to do, and the answers that people agree. And he'd been then looking to see how can we, you know, productize that? How can we turn that into a platform? So, he's the VC guy in the relationship. I'm the tech product guy in the relationship. And then we've got a wonderful team, including developers, our chief legal officer, Deborah McCargill, who's an ex-barrister and has done years of funding rounds. So together, we've got the partner who knows what VCs and investors want. I guess me, hopefully, understanding what startups want, and the product market fit guy, and then our legal team and chief legal officer to make it legal. So what we did is we tried to look at every aspect of a round. And I think here it's fascinating because I talk to lots of startups every day. And I think whenever you have a startup idea, there's a question about, do you look to solve a very simple current problem or do you look to change the world? And if you look to solve a very simple current problem, that's nice, but it's probably not futuristic enough that, firstly, if it's a simple problem to be solved, probably many other people have solved this. And secondly, investors aren't interested because they see the opportunities too short term. On the flip side, if you want to change everything, we're going to change all UK startups and the world startups to blockchain. It's very nice, but it's probably so crazy that you'll never actually be able to build it before you run out of money. So that's less good as well. So I think for me, what I have realized is if you can both deliver a short-term utility objective to give people what they want now, while also having a longer-term vision that helps you become investable yourself and also, you know, develop your roadmap. So really everything we're doing is both to solve a simple set of problems for people today. In other words, if it took 3 months to arrange a bunch and thousands of pounds to do a round, why does it not need to be 3 days instead of 3 months? And then in the future, we will look to transform the entire way that investors and startups connect to use data, which we're already doing. So instead of people having passionate, you know, fights with co-founders about whether they should have share vesting or not, or with their investors about investor consent, I can just show you some data that goes, actually, in this percent of cases, this is the answer. It doesn't mean you have to do that, but it means there's a high likelihood that if you do, your round will close faster. And actually, just as a complete aside, it's interesting when I have startups going or founders going, I'd like to create bespoke legals just for this round. And the answer is, actually, that's a really bad thing to do, because if you think about it, a funding round is a marketplace where people who want money connect with people who have money. And the most efficient marketplace is a marketplace that runs on standard rules. If the rules are standardized, your transaction is much better. And imagine you think about a rental car. An investor investing in your startup is very much like you getting a rental car. If every rental car had the steering wheel and the pedals in a different place and the gear lever with a different set of gear settings, it would be a nightmare. It works much better when you hop into your local Hertz rental car and sit in the car and, gee, everything's in the same place. You can drive off in about 3 minutes after adjusting the mirrors. And a funding round is the same for an investor. For the most part, this is not their first rodeo. And the last thing they want is some crazy handcrafted things that gives the founders something, you know, like 101 votes per share or something ridiculous. Instead, what they want is the same set of things that they see in every other round.
Cool. Thanks. Yeah, so pretty good overview of what you guys are up to. Yeah, I will definitely add that you guys seem to do really good work with the data that you have, and your blog is amazing. It's like such a good resource for any startup just wanting to know more about what the hell goes on with the funding round and what they should be thinking about. And the whole platform is pretty nice. How did you, because you said you're kind of three divisions and you're just the one leading product. So you manage all the development side of things? Because it looks like a really nicely done.
So, one of the other interesting challenges in a startup is how sort of centralized are you on your development and how decentralized. So if you can have a team that interacts with your customers, they totally understand the customers themselves. So we use Intercom. So every time a customer says, I'm having problems with this or I don't understand that, it's not that someone has to write a ticket and a spec. In fact, everyone gets to see it. And what is brings joy to me every day is when, you know, I might see some customer report something and lo and behold, I log onto the site later and it's miraculously fixed. Why? Because actually everybody is incentivized. The way we love to work is we love to see people wanting something in us in the shortest possible time. And then I think the other thing is in the space we're in, which is legal, it's a fabulous place to want to disrupt because, firstly, lawyers charge a lot. Secondly, they do the same thing again and again. Every funding round is an island. So you may agree something with some lawyers and your investors, and next door to you in your accelerator is somebody else doing exactly the same thing, each spending a great deal of time and money reinventing the wheel every time. And just because the way people interact with law firms, each one is an island. But thanks to technology, it shouldn't be. And that's really the underpinnings of our data blog. So if I can simply go over many rounds, actually, this is where everyone ends up. You don't need to have the same painful realization process to get there. You can just jump to the answer immediately. So I think the wonderful thing is because all the data is there, if you can sort of look under the hood and extract it, and key to that is the fact that when you do a legal document, all the information that you really want to agree in the round is encoded in thousands of words of legalese. You know, if you say, I would like to have investor consent on these company decisions, it's encoded in lots and lots of words that are different pretty much in every deal. So you can never really extract it in a way that is scalable. But because we insist that you enter the key deal terms and our platform builds the legals, we've got all the inputs, which is almost an unexpected surprise. I mean, we obviously had that in mind, but we had people enter the inputs because that was the plain English way that you would understand it. But having done that, you now have the same standardized set of things across many, many rounds, and you can now leverage this in all sorts of ways. So today we leverage it by nice blog posts and an increasing set of data on our site. But in the future, imagine that AI will start guiding you to almost, you can imagine saying, these are my investors, and then we know the deals that they've done in the past, and we know that this guy's an angel investor, and that's a fund, and we know that you're looking for 500K, and we know that you're in property or something. Imagine the system can just go, well, actually, looking over these rounds and looking at what these investors want, I would suggest these deal terms for you, because that's where you're most likely to close your round. And maybe it'll also say this investor isn't right for you because they want terms that, you know, are not going to match the round size that you've got. So, for example, often you'll find, I think often founders believe that a VC is the way they should go. And in fact, it's if you're looking for £1 million plus, that's probably your answer. If you're looking for 200K, going to VC is a horrible mismatch. VCs are looking for scale up. So they're looking to see revenue most typically, and they're going to get valuations based on revenue and so on. And they're also going to want consent rights. They're going to want an investor director position. They want valuations that are underpinned by data and so on. But if you're looking for 200K, you probably pre-launch or just post-launch. And if you go to the VC, they will probably, after kicking the tires for a few weeks or months, say, you're not right. And you've wasted everyone's time. And actually, you're much better just doing a simple SEIS round, raising 200K from a bunch of angel investors who will get their tax deductions and other SEIS benefits. And you then use Seed Legals to close the round really quickly, you know, either as a single round or flexibly. So I think there are a lot of things when you understand the way the dynamics work. It turns out that a UK round, and soon it will be other countries as well, turns out, although almost nobody knows it, to be hugely formulaic. And once you've spotted the formula, you can just guide people towards the formula because that's the one that's most effective.
Cool. Yeah, well, yeah, some pretty good advice there on what to do because I'm, yeah, been currently thinking about whether to go for SEIS or wait a bit and go for something bigger, like a sort of 6 months time, or just not do any investment at all, depending on how the product goes.
Right. So I mean, if I can hop right in there, right? The purpose of a funding round. I mean, if you need money for your startup, there are basically three options. You can pay for it yourself, in other words, bootstrapping. You can borrow money, or you can raise money for equity. The bootstrapping yourself is by far the best thing to do until you can no longer afford it. As my business partner wisely points out, you can never own more than 100% of the company. So if you keep putting money in yourself, it's nice because the valuation goes up, but it becomes inefficient because you're unlikely to be able to fund it yourself to scale. So at some point, your inability to fund it further becomes a limiting factor on growing. And at that point, it makes sense to get other people's money. And then, you know, if you're a cheese shop and you're selling cheese, debt is the way to go. You borrow money from the bank. They understand you sold so many bars of cheese last week. If you borrow more money, you can sell more cheese and you can pay back the investment. So borrowing money is perfect for bricks and mortar business that the growth will be slow and predictable and you're going to use money to buy stock. But this is the opposite to the way most startups work. You've got some crazy idea that could go big or go bust, I suppose. You never want to go bust, but it may not grow or go anywhere. And that is where equity investment comes in. So investors make a bet that their investment is either going to be worth 5x or whatever it might be in some year or more. Or, you know, if it doesn't work out, well, you know, they're spreading their bets over several startups and they are going to de-risk it by getting their SEIS 50% tax deduction or EIS 30% tax deduction. So if it doesn't work, they can also, with SEIS, write off the investment as well. So it turns out with SEIS, the investor's risk is about 13 pence in the pound. So it hugely de-risks it. So, you know, coming back to your example, really you've got, I suppose, the answer of, do I keep funding it myself? And at what point does it make sense to get investment? And then when I get investment, do I raise sort of 50K? Or do I wait to raise hundreds of K? And I think it comes down to perhaps the decision on when to raise first is, at what point is my valuation high enough that I'm not going to give away too much equity for the money that I need to have next? So your goal then is to fund it yourself to that point. So let me give you an example. You know, if you've got a PowerPoint that shows your wonderful idea, the PowerPoint itself is unlikely to be worth a great deal. And investors are very likely to say, come back when you've got an MVP. So you pretty much have to fund the development of it yourself, because few investors other than friends and family are likely to fund your PowerPoint. But having now built something, you can now go and talk to investors. I should add, by the way, that I think there are two good times to raise investment and one less good time. So I think the good time to raise investment is on the back of some validated idea, but well before launch, or two, well after launch when you've got traction. The bad time to raise investment is just about at launch. So I think people, unfortunately, think the best time to get investment is they're going to launch and then I'm going to get traction and I'll get investment. But it turns out it's rarely the case that you get traction right after launch. More likely, the vast majority of the time, you launch, ta-da, maybe in the best case you get a TechCrunch article, you get a spike of activity, but actually you haven't really got product market fit. So if you are going to investors right after launch, and you've got 500 users and, you know, you're not sure that they're coming back to the site and so on, this would actually be the worst time to raise revenue, because you're almost proving the point that you don't have traction. So what you really want is you want to raise investment on the hype and the promise well before launch. We've got this amazing new bicycle finder that will miraculously find your bicycle anywhere in London if it's stolen. Yeah. So, yeah, okay, great. I'll buy into that on a half call valuation and I'll invest, you know, 30K for my EIS and SEIS. No idea if it's going to work, but I'll buy into the vision. You now need to have raised enough money to not just get that to launch, but actually get enough traction that you can come back afterwards and say, now at a million or a million and a half valuation, I now have sufficient traction, users, revenue, whatever your metric is, that you will say to investors, great, I can now raise 250K at a 1.5 million valuation to scale. And you have to have made it through that doldrums of post-launch when actually, you know, ta-da, it's launched, but where are my users? Well, actually, they just haven't heard of you yet. So yeah, you have to work to find that and use the money to find that. So yes, strong advice is raise enough money to get you post-launch to the point that you can have a significant increase in valuation and then raise more on that valuation later.
Cool. I think everyone will value that for running a startup. But yeah, it's really poignant because we have built the MVP and we're now in the middle stage of product market fit where we couldn't handle a million people using us all at once. And we're not sort of actively going for that. We are just working with like a small amount of people and making it nice to the point where we have some traction and can sort of prove, okay, when we spend £1 on advertising, we will make like £2 within 6 months back kind of thing. But we just have like a few months of the process, maybe longer than a few months to sort of prove that model and work it all through.
And I think that's exactly it. Often you'll hear founders being so obsessed that their spreadsheet forecasting is correct. It's a complete wild gamble that it will be correct. So, you know, you'll find a founder say, you know, my model predicts £5 million of revenue by, you know, year two or three or something like that. So I'm just going to, I don't need funding. I'm just going to wait to get there. And you go, dude, if your spreadsheet is correct, that's fantastic. Problem is, what if it's not correct? And how do you handle it then? And I've seen enough plans to know that very rarely is that spreadsheet model correct. More likely, certainly just post-launch, you will under your predictions. And hopefully by year two, you've caught up with your predictions. They might still be insanely optimistic. So how do you deal with the scenario which isn't? And that's the entire point of risk. That's why you get equity rather than going to the bank and borrowing money. It's because angel investors are happy to take a risk based on the reward. And the reward is, you know, let's go 5x or 10x or whatever multiple some period later. If it doesn't work out, you get a tax write-off with your SEIS. And that's the dance routine for a funding round. Little steps each way, but multiplied each time.
Cool. Yeah, so I guess what I would like to know is, what did you do for Seed Legals?
So it was quite interesting because I think when I look at founders or look at startups, there are a number of problems to solve. And if you think about in your startup, what is the biggest proof point? And I think they are as follows. Number one, can you get a team together? Many people struggle to put a team together. Can you get investment? Can you build it? Maybe it turns out it's a really complicated technical thing. You just will be unable to build it. Will you be able to get, will users want it or customers want it? And will you be able to get them, you know, to come and find them? And I think for many startups, the problems are largely about, can I build it? Can I build a team? Can I get investment? So these are your starting problems. With Seed Legals, between my business partner and I, we've been around for a while. So between us, we knew we could get investment. I knew I could build a team. I was pretty confident I could build it. We could build it. And I was also, from having spoken to enough startups, explaining what we were looking to do, that they were saying, amazing, I would like us. The question, in fact, was for me, not any of them. Actually, I could raise investment, I could build a team, I could build a product, I hoped, and I was pretty confident people would want it. But I had a different problem, which is, what if startups all wanted to use Seed Legals, but the investors said, no way? Or the lawyers said, the legals are rubbish, you just can't do it. So actually, that was my proof point that I needed to solve. And the way I look to solve that is the way I think startups should always solve problems, which is bootstrap as far as you can yourself and create the MVP. So the MVP is generally the swan is gliding beautifully above the water, but underneath this frantic paddling. So in our case, essentially we figured, what do we need to build so that above the surface it looks like it's all working? Beneath the surface, it's still going to be a great set of legals, but actually it may not be quite as automated as we might like. So beneath the surface on our first rounds, the between myself, my business partner, our chief legal officer, there was a lot of hasty drafting of documents based on, it's like, oh, you need this deal term, quick, enhance the docs to do that. But what was interesting is we quickly became product market fit, I guess, in that we made a guess as to the deal terms needed for an early stage round. And then as people asked for things we didn't do, we rushed to get them on the platform. But actually, after doing that a few times and having done a few rounds, you can now actually quite quickly see, hey, the deal terms you want fall into one of two buckets. Either we should have it on the platform and we're deficient, or there's a good reason we don't have it. It's because either what you're asking is wrong, or what you're asking is something that actually could be done in a different way, or something you probably don't want to do. So I've gone on a tangent here, but it was quite interesting to see at what point it crossed over from the next request is, oh no, we need to get this on the platform, to, oh wait, you really don't want to do that. So the first time someone said, you know, you don't have 5-year founder vesting, it's like, do we need to add 5-year vesting? No, 5-year vesting is just a bad idea. You'll be old as a quarter of your life. So we go to 4 years and we're not doing 5 years because we think it's a bad idea. And so now I would say 90% of the time people ask us for something, it's either done on the platform already, or we think it's a really bad idea and you shouldn't do it. And the fact it's not on the platform is not that we haven't thought about it. We've thought about it. We've intentionally chosen to not do it because we want to guide people to, maybe you'll call us and we'll explain why you probably shouldn't do that. It might be someone trying to circumvent the SEIS rules, but HRMRC is pretty wise to that. Or maybe a founder saying, I'd like to pay myself dividends instead of paying a salary to reduce my tax, which sounds like a great idea. But there's a reason we don't do it. It's because you have to pay all your investors dividends and so on as well. It's just not going to work. So to come to the answer to your question on Seed Legals, sorry on that huge ramble, my business partner and I each funded the company ourselves to the point that it made sense to get outside investment. So, you know, with I guess a team of 2 or 3 people, we could fund it ourselves. With a team of 5 or 6, it was getting crazy. Mm. And so at that point, we raised investment. But I think
that you had customers and an MVP at that point.
We had customers. We definitely had an MVP. I think what was interesting is that we planned to raise investment probably about 4 months earlier than we did. Mm. And I think this was unique just to us because we were insisting, of course, on using Seed Legals for our own round. There was no way we were not going to use our platform, you know, eating your own dog food, so to say.
Yeah, yeah.
That was rule one, we use Seed Legals. And so everything we wanted to do in our own round, we then basically wanted the platform to be perfect. It needed to deal with SEIS and EIS in the round because we were raising £1 million. It needed to deal with giving share certificates because we wanted that to be done. All the e-signatures needed to be working. Then some of our investors, you know, were investing through a company or through a trust, so it needed to deal with that. So basically, as we saw more things that, I guess the only thing we didn't do MVP in our entire operation was our own funding round, where we kept delaying it just to make it perfect. So I guess we just had personal pride that the whole thing would happen on the platform. So we probably pushed the round back several months later than we could have closed, just because we wanted the platform to be perfect for our own round. So yes.
Cool. Yeah.
Which meant the round, you know, I think we originally wanted to raise about 300 or 500K, but because we kept futzing around, you know, making it better, we just, and people kept saying, could they invest? We just kept growing the size of the round. So, but yes, so long story there. Sorry about the
digression. Hey, so much good things. I'm trying to make as many notes as you're going along. But yeah, it's a really good point about dog feeding as you're going. We've been trying to dog feed what we're doing. So I should probably say we're basically building a marketing tool that lets you dynamically send personalized posts to people, so like physical posts in the mail. Yeah, so we've started like making our own campaigns to sort of onboard people with sort of really nice messaging of don't get left behind and like the unpersonalized mail and like nice graphics and sort of really good jokes and things. And it's really effective and being able to track everything that's going on is really cool. But we haven't got that, as in if you're talking about the white swan sort of,
yeah,
our platform itself, you can basically just add someone's name to like a postcard and that's more than nothing. But if anybody wants it, we can build behind it all the extra dynamic stuff. So say that you wanted to send one to like someone that just finished raising a round, we could do that and be like, okay, this is, you can put like the whole data of all the investors, or like you can just give a nice summary and like we could create a dynamic graph for each different business. And it would be totally easy for us to do behind the scenes, but we'd have to like talk to you about it and build it still.
That's right. So you've got the classic startup, startup, assuming people want your service, you now spend hundreds of thousands of pounds building a complete mailing platform and the whole thing, or do you knock up the website, say we you know, submit your form here and it will be automatically mailed, and then you sit on the kitchen floor filling in envelopes.
Yeah.
Obviously, well, that's not going to scale too well. That's going to last you for about 3 minutes. But it's almost interesting to see how many people will push the button to go, yes, I'd like to
send. Yeah, yeah, we probably should have really done that, to be honest. We kind of went a bit far and built like a full-on online editor and stuff first. And like our first big client now is probably not going to need the editor because they want too much other stuff anyway. So he could have not built anything and still done it with them. And
I think that's interesting, and nothing to do with your use case, but I think one of the biggest problems with startups that I see is they build too much stuff. The problem is the building of stuff is seen as the definition of success. But in fact, not building anything is the more stuff you build, it takes time, it costs money, and worst of all, you become emotionally attached to it and you don't want to get rid of it.
Yeah.
So it may turn out everyone wants to connect, you know, via an API, hypothetically in this case, and no one wants an editor. But because you built an editor, you now feel that you have to, you know, get people to use the editor.
Yeah.
I've been
missing the whole what customers want that you're talking about.
Exactly. And so I've spoken to many startups and they explain, you know, all the stuff, we're building the stuff with AI and we've got this machine learning, we're looking for data scientists. And I go, dude, I've gone to your website and it doesn't reflect any of that. Why didn't you just figure out the least effort you need to satisfy what it says on your website? And it's like, well, we've got these three data scientists, we need to keep them busy and so on. But that's kind of backwards. You're better off not having the data scientists and just figure out the least work to give people what, you know, the promises on the site. And at some point you may need the data scientists, but you probably don't need them on day one. I mean, if your marketplace is matching people and you only have eight people, you don't need a data scientist. You just need the founder to go, you all match. There you go. So, and when you start paying for the service, then we'll start, when we've got enough customers paying for it and enough people that I can't match them manually, then we'll start building a better solution.
Sweet. Yeah. So, since we're talking about getting product market fit and like how much time you put in with customers, so you reckon that you put a lot more time in than most of the businesses that you see, even though they still successfully close rounds and make a good business out of it?
I don't know what the average startup does, but I think what was interesting in our case is there is a particular thing that was done by humans, which is legal documents. Yeah. And I didn't want to build a law firm. I wanted to build a platform. And the question is, are people ready for a platform or do they still need to talk to humans? And this was the space that I was wandering into. And obviously, in any bot-type space, it's exactly what other people are doing, whether it's talk to a virtual doctor or a chat bot or a virtual accountant or, you know, perform. Anytime you used to go to a human, you're now going to do it online. And now your business can evolve in several different ways. You could end up with a pure tech dev team and a lot of AWS instances, and that's it. You're a pure tech play. The other alternative is that you're essentially a call center with humans, And a simple tech platform that is, you know, front of house is people and back of house, you're doing whatever people did before, but just slightly more efficiently, which I must say doesn't really turn me on. So what I realized quite quickly is that our platform is just insanely good at doing what people did before. It literally in 100 milliseconds builds every document that a human took 3 days of messing around in Word to do. And it does it with 100% accuracy. Every line number is correct, or, you know, clause reference is correct. Every cap table calculation is correct. But what people want as founders is this is their first time doing a round, and they need somebody to talk to. And if you go, the machine builds everything instantly, that is great, but doesn't really help them, because the problems they've got are things like my founder, you know, saying I want 4-year vesting and I want 3-year vesting. What should I do? So it's actually, in our case, not really ultimately about the legals. It's about helping people solve a set of problems. And in some cases, the answer is legal documents. And in some cases, it's advice. So really then what I set out to do was listen to what each person wanted and try to solve it in the most scalable way. And so, you know, initially it's to get on the phone or on a Skype call with people. But as I see trends emerge, can I, for example, use Intercom and write an article? So by the fourth time somebody asks, can a family relative qualify for SEIS? Instead of writing out an answer, I can write an article and then have Intercom suggest the article. The second thing I can do is I can start using data. So perhaps people might ask, you know, should I give a consent right to an investor? There's no right or wrong answer, but you might guide them to an article with data that helps them. So I think what's fascinating is when you are creating something which is replacing what humans do with what a machine can do, maybe like a self-driving car, you know, people aren't ready for a self-driving car on day one. Perhaps there needs to be a self-driving car, but with a driver, you know, assist in a sense. And I guess that someone's described what we're doing with Seed Legals as a man plus machine interface, which is jointly people plus computer will help you solve the problem that you had much more efficiently than before. And actually, depending how much help you need, either you grab the steering wheel and go, or, you know, you let the car drive itself, or you have a passenger sitting next to you helping you, or you can get concierge service and we'll drive and, you know, you sit next to us. So it's quite interesting, and to see some founders need a great deal of help. Others just go, I totally know what I'm doing. I'll let you know when I need you.
Yeah, I guess. So someone like me that hasn't really done raising before would probably be wanting to be caught to you a bit more often, whereas someone that's sort of done loads of rounds and just knows exactly what's going on.
Exactly. And if you think perhaps about the questions you've asked on this podcast, actually, although the goal is to build all the legals for your round, actually all the questions you've asked have nothing to do with the legals.
Yeah.
And if you went to a lawyer, it would be an insane waste of money, because your lawyer would know fuck all about the questions you've asked, which is, you know, should I fund it myself? Should I bootstrap it? Should I, you know, do a convertible note? Should I get raised a little bit? Lawyers know absolutely nothing about that. They will tell you the answer to all solutions, to all problems is 5,000 or 15,000 words of legalese. But actually, that's only the answer to one outcome. What you really wanted is somebody who understands startup rounds to go, hey, actually, you've got these three options, and this one sounds the best for you. Mm. And actually, fine to tell you the best is fund it yourself for the next 3 months to get to the point that, you know, you could then do the next step, for example.
Yeah.
So yes, I think people perceive often that in the space we're in, the answer is legals, but actually the answer is here are the things to do, and only in some cases, you know, are legals involved.
Yeah, I think very much when you are first starting a business that's doing something new, as well as getting customer market fit, from your end is also educating the market their end, like when you're spending the time with them. Whereas after a few years and become more mature, there's a lot of people already using it. People adopt things more easily anyway.
Yeah, so I like, is it Bezos who said, you know, he likes to play a seven-year game. His investors all wanted a return on 3 years. And since, you know, getting traction in 3 years is often difficult, if he's in it for seven, the others will run out of money at three. He's the only survivor. It turns out that, I mean, it looks, at least in Amazon's case, it looks like a good strategy. In my case, the way I look at it is, it's almost like a Snapchat thing, you know. Kids using Snapchat are just never going to use it, make a phone call again. Why? You can't send video, you can't send emoji, you can't send text. Once you've discovered a new way of doing things, you're never going to go back. So people might go, well, you know, if it's a £5 million round, we all want to go to lawyers. It's like, yeah, dude, knock yourself out. You know, I've got enough people doing early stage rounds. And guess what? The customers who and companies who found Seed Legals a year ago are now on their second or third round. They just never go anywhere else, because the next time, if you use the platform where everyone e-signs and another turn of the documents, as we always call it, actually is about 4 seconds, the next time someone says, I'll send you next Wednesday a red line document with changes, you're going to go, hey, what planet are you from? You know, I've never done things that way. So, I'm actually totally delighted that I start with earlier rounds. It works great with later stage rounds, but I don't have to fight the system, because I know that with time, more and more companies are on the platform and they'll automatically do later stage rounds.
Cool. So it'd be good to go into some of the legals, because I'm going to speak more about like just the general mindset of what I should be looking for in investment or someone would do as an entrepreneur. But what about the actual legal mistakes? Like, what would you say are the biggest things for people to watch out for, or mistakes that people often make?
So I think number one by a country mile is make sure everyone you give shares to has vesting. So when founders start out, they are all on board the rocket ship, but and they think everything's going to be peachy. But it turns out things take longer than you expect. Things go wrong, personalities, mismatches occur. And the team splits up. And I reckon in about 10% of the case of the time I see, the founders split up. And the problem is, if you don't have share vesting in place and an IP assignment, everything could get completely screwed. So what is share vesting, for those who don't know? The idea is that when you create a company, and let's say there are two founders, you split the equity 50-50 each. So you make 100 shares on company house and you get 50 shares each. And the problem then is, after 6 months, one of you decides, oh, I've got a job with Facebook, I'm off. And if they keep their 50%, basically the company's uninvestable. No investor put money into a company where 50% of the shares are owned by an underperforming founder who, if the split was acrimonious, it's even worse than that. So essentially, if a founder leaves, they have to give back all or some of their shares, and that's called vesting. And vesting, probably there are two most common vesting plans. One of them is 3-year straight line vesting from when the company was incorporated. So the founders get together, they incorporate, and they say, my shares will vest over 3 years, which means if I leave after 1 year, I keep a third of my shares and have to give back, sell back at nominal value for like a cent each, my remaining shares. And that way, the shares go back to the company, which essentially dissolves them, which means that there are now more shares available to bring on a new co-founder. And another way of vesting is what's called 4-year with a 12-month cliff, which means the shares will vest over 4 years. But if you leave in the first 12 months, you keep nothing. And this is something that investors will often insist on to make sure the founders stay together for the first year at least, because otherwise, if you leave, you generally, you know, weren't right and you keep nothing. So the biggest mistake by far I see is founders, you know, the way it starts, you're friends at uni or you get together at a party, you have an idea, and over a few pub drinks, you decide to do a startup. and then slowly it morphs from a hobby into something full-time, and cut to you've now spent the last 6 months on us, but you've never really got any documentation together. And now something goes wrong. One of the founders gets bored, decides it doesn't like the other founder, gets a job, and they go off. And now there's a dispute. And the question is, who owns the intellectual property? And if you haven't got an IP assignment, basically the thing could be dead on arrival, which is even if it was your idea, if your co-founder, you know, starts having an IP dispute, no one's going to invest in it, and you may not even ever be able to continue with what's your baby because you've got a dispute on it. You may have to give up on it and find something else to do. So what you want is, as soon as it crosses over from being a hobby into something that is essentially a full-time gig, in other words, something you think's got legs, then you need to have an IP assignment and share vesting. And all of that you can do in Seed Legals in about 5 minutes flat. It's called a founder agreement. We've got two types of founder agreements. There's a founder pledge, which is for really early startups where no one's earning a salary. And there's a founder service agreement, which is when you're earning a salary, then it includes employment provisions and termination and various other things. So there's no excuse to not do that. You know, lawyers would charge hundreds of pounds for this. You can do this completely free on Seed Legals in minutes. We'll guide you through the standard terms. You know, what are the equity? What are the vesting? What are the IP assignment? What are the non-disclosure things? And build those documents for you. So that's thing number one. Thing number two is, it's not really a mistake, but at some point you need to do a share split. So most founders create the company on company house with 100 shares at £1 each. Great, works nicely, but it doesn't work when you want to do your funding round. So let's say you want to raise £200,000 and you're going to give away 15% equity. So you had 100 shares. If you're giving away 15% equity, that means you're going to make 17 new shares. So the 17 new shares are going to be 15%. Roughly of the 117 shares that will exist after the round. And that means you're raising 200K, you're making 17 shares, each share is going to be worth £13,000 or something like that. It's not going to work. So your investors who want to invest 5K or a multiple of 10K, you're not going to make it fit a multiple of 13K. So you want to do a share split. And I would suggest making 1,000-to-1 share split in that case. So you have 100,000 shares before the round, and the price per share is now £13. So you can accurately match the investment for each investor. And sometimes lawyers will charge hundreds of pounds to do a share split. No, do not do that. You can do this for free in Seed Legals in about 3 minutes. It will build you a shareholder resolution and an SHO2 document that go to company house. You just say, I'd like to do 100,000-to-1 share split. Bingo, it's created the documents for you, filled in the SHO2, you download it, you post it, because company house needs that one physically posted. Maybe we can use Postery to post it to them. That might actually be a cool idea. Would you like to post it? It will cost you £5 extra just to post it. Click here and, you know, it will send that PDF to your system and it gets sent physically. Actually, that's a pretty cool idea.
Yeah, cool.
I see our partnership already.
Yeah, deals.
So yes, the share split, I think, is probably the next thing. And what else could be after? I think the next thing is just calculating your valuation and the amount of equity you want to give away. So I think people fall into two groups. Either they give away too much equity because their investor, at least for early stage friends and family rounds, they have no idea what the valuation should be. They're a bit embarrassed to have like £500,000 valuation, and they end up giving away 30% equity for, you know, 50K of investment. Mm-hmm. So my pre-money valuation will be 100K. I'm raising 50K. So the investors will get 33% of the 150K post-money valuation. And the problem is you've now made yourself uninvestable, because investors now coming in at a later round will realize the founder will have too little equity, too little skin in the game too soon, and will lose interest and go and do other things. So do not give away too much equity early on. The median amount, and you can go to Seed Legals and in the resources section, you'll find in the deal data area graphs for all of this. We find the median amount of equity people are giving away in a round is 15%. So think carefully about giving away much more than 15%, because maybe your valuation is too low and you might be much better off raising less to then get to a higher valuation so that you can raise more without giving away as much equity. The other mistake founders often make is they calculate the value, the equity dilution incorrectly. So if you're raising 150K on a £1 million valuation, founders will go, great, you're getting 15%, but no, you're getting 13.09%, because you're getting, the investors will end up with 150K out of 1.15 million, not out of 1 million. And the problem is if you screw up your equity calculation, it's kind of embarrassing. The investors are not going to believe your three-year business plan to change the world with your blockchain technology if you couldn't get the fucking equity dilution right, you know, on a simple calculation. So my suggestion is model your round on Seed Legals. You can start your round for free. There is no excuse to get the valuation and, or rather the equity dilution calculations wrong. You just start your round on Seed Legals. You say, I'm looking to raise 150K. And when you enter £1 million, you'll see it's showing you 13%. Actually, if you set it to 850K pre-money, that is 15% equity that you're giving away for raising 150K. So you should model that first before you talk to investors, because it looks kind of embarrassing when you get it wrong. And there's no reason to do so.
Cool. Thanks. Yeah, really useful advice. Yeah, made thanks on all of those things. So I guess that goes through starting and raising investment. You said that you're really good at building teams, or you feel confident on that. I would like to know, what's your favorite question to ask someone when you're hiring?
I think I've been through the favorite question stage many, many years ago. It was one of those sort of Mensa test things, and but I got bored with it. I don't think there's any favorite question. For me, the problem is that everyone's resume looks the same. You know, I've got 3 years of Python, I'm a full stack developer, yada, yada. There's nothing to really differentiate on most resumes. So what you want is you want to see the person's the right fit for your company. And for right fit, I think in the case of a startup, it's less about what you've done on your resume, but mostly what you've done in your spare time. Are you an entrepreneur yourself? I would love everyone in my company to be a future entrepreneur. It means that essentially I'm mentoring people who in due course will leave the company, which is very sad, but I would like them to think through every transaction as if they were the founder themselves. So almost, you know, I tell people never do what I tell you to, because I'm almost certainly you're going to think, if you think it through better, please take what I'm asking you as what I would like, but the how, you should think it through yourself. I guess what I'm looking for on a resume is, you know, what's your GitHub repository? What other things are you doing in your spare time? I'm not interested if you play rugby or soccer or sail, that's irrelevant. I'm interested in what startup things you've done yourself. If you've built a mini legal tech startup, in my case, and given up on it because actually you saw Seed Legals was already there, amazing. If you've created something and it didn't work out, great. You know, if you're busy on something as a side project, amazing. So I'm really looking for that spark to see how you will bring that spark within my company. I'm looking for people who are not going to wait for me to tell them what to do. They're going to figure it out themselves. because actually, as a founder in a startup, you're insanely busy. You're much better off with a team who's thinking about things and acting as mini entrepreneurs themselves. I think the converse problem is often the main problem in London, which is, as a small startup, how can you attract talent? Mm. And because it's a hot space, you don't have that much money that you can pay. How do you stick out? So, you know, if you're a developer in London, you have a lot of choice. How, as a startup, do you get, you know, a developer to choose me rather than someone else? And I think there the answer is, when you're a developer, you're looking to back a winner. You want a company that's going to be around, that the results of your labor will turn into something. You want to be the next hot company. So if you're the founder, you need to make as much noise as you can. So when the developer is looking around, they're looking on Facebook groups in London startups, they're looking on LinkedIn, they're doing a Google news search on your company, you want to be everywhere. And I'm reminded, I think it was Napoleon, who was in one of his earlier battles, greatly outnumbered by the enemy. So what he did is he sent his troops out in the evening to light fires on the hills surrounding the enemy where they were camped out. And the idea was the enemy would go, oh, no, they're everywhere. We're completely surrounded. Never mind, it was only six people lighting a bonfire on a bunch of hills. He only had a small number. So if you can start blogging, putting posts out on LinkedIn, in Facebook groups, if you can get articles written, if you can manage to get TechCrunch to write something, but it doesn't have to be TechCrunch, can you post articles on Medium? Can you, on Facebook groups, when people are asking questions and things in that area, be a knowledge leader? And now, suddenly, you're punching above your weight. Somebody, a developer, going, these people with those amazing bicycle thing, I've totally no idea whether it's two people dreaming of something or this. So they do a bit of Googling and it's like, hey, I keep noticing these bicycle lock people everywhere. Man, that's happening. I need to be part of that. So as the founder, get out, spread the word as much as you can, network as much as you can, tell people what you're doing. No one's going to copy you because they want to, they would have done that already. The last thing that you do is, you know, founders often go, you know, I should be secret. No, someone's going to copy me. It's like, well, imagine you saw there was a company doing a new bicycle lock. Will you immediately go, I'm going to drop everything and do a new bicycle lock? Or are you going to go, it's weightless life and I'll use that bicycle lock? So chances are, I mean, there might be some, obviously, areas with long gestation times and, you know, there really is something to be had from keeping a secret. But the vast majority, spread the word and you'll get feedback about whether people really want it. And investors, developers will come out of the woodwork and be interested. So yes, advice, spread the word, make as much noise as you can, because that's the way people see you as being a success.
Cool. That's awesome. Thanks.
Well, crikey. I hope you were taking notes, because I can't possibly cover all of my takeaways from this episode in the wrap-up. But you can, of course, look in the show notes for extra info on all the details that we did speak about. And then Seed Legals do run a great blog, as I've said. So every time Anthony gets a question multiple times, they basically write an article about it. So it's a really good resource, even if you don't make an account on Seed Legals. I would say that sometimes Anthony does give lawyers a bit of a bad rap, as there certainly are some that do have a lot of experience in startup and investing, but there are a lot that don't. And in terms of what you get for your money, it does seem like you can save a lot of cash and time using Seed Legals. And Anthony is certainly a wealth of advice. So if you're getting tips from him, it seems a great app to be paying for. Having never raised millions or used a lawyer or Seed Legals in the process, and I can't really speak from experience on this, but it would be interesting to have a lawyer on the show to hear their side of things. Anthony does do a great job of selling Seed Legals, which I would normally edit out a bit more, but it does kind of make sense with everything else that he's saying. And if you were to choose an equivalent legal tech firm, I guess that's up to you. I do have a lawyer friend in the US, for example, who's part of a team doing pretty much the exact same thing, but for the United States. So it's definitely an option there. Also, he talked himself into using Postery, so I think I kind of owe him one anyway. On to my biggest take-homes. Number one, have a founder agreement. This is one piece of advice I do have experience in, and I will tell you, it did save my life. Number two, there are good times and bad times to raise investment. Don't try to raise at the same time as launching and proving traction, because it'll probably make the proving and traction slower and just have a difficult time raising money, and it'll just be a bit of a cluster F word. So don't do that. Raise at other times and life will be good. Number three, shout about your business and just make yourself seem big and try to appear everywhere. So news articles, meetups, online groups, and it's just really good for your marketing and for attracting talent. So that's just a really good piece of advice. Sadly, we didn't have time to talk about books. If you are in the process of raising money, etc., then a great book is called Venture Deals. It basically goes through what seems to me to be everything you need to know about the process and what all the different clauses in a term sheet mean and what you need to focus on. And on that note, I hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you have a business idea, good luck with it. I really hope that this helped you, and I'll be back next week. You've just listened to an episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your preferred app and give me a good rating, as these go a really long way. If you are unable to give good feedback right now, try sharing the show with a friend who will, or just wait for the show to improve. If you have any ideas for the show or you just want to chat, then please reach out to me on Twitter at SamHarrisTweets or Instagram at SamJamSnaps. Show notes and other links to topics discussed in the episodes are available at the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com. Thanks so much for listening. Give yourself a big hug from me. If you're with a friend, give them a hug as well. And I hope you enjoy your next podcast.